Ken Burns documentary Baseball, and in 2006 received Sabre's highest award, the Bob Davis Award. On March 1st this year, John was named the official historian of Major League Baseball. John Thorne. We've picked a fairly narrow topic today, baseball in the last 40 years. In the next half hour or 40 minutes, and leave room for discussion and questions afterwards. August 10th, 1971, Sabre was founded at Cooperstown. I was privileged to be one of those in attendance. What else happened that day? In Hoffman Estates, Illinois, a baby was born, Sal Fasano, who went on to a 12-year major league career. The only player born that day. Harmon Killebrew hit home runs number 500 and 501 of his career. Wes Parker went 2-for-4 in a game against the Phillies. The Dodgers won, had an RBI single against Hall of Famer, future Hall of Famer Jim Bunning that day. Of the major league ballparks in use in 1971, only five are still in use. Several teams have had new parks that have already been demolished. Veterans Stadium and the Kingdome came and went since Sabre was founded. Baseball expanded from 24 to 30 teams. Arizona, Colorado, Florida, and Toronto each got a team for the first time. Seattle got a team for the second time. Washington, D.C. lost a team and got another one. Canada lost half their teams. The Milwaukee Brewers went from the American League West to the American League East to American League Central to the National League. Every major league team has set new attendance records. Interest is at an all-time high. Roland, you've been around through all those years at the top level of baseball. Could you share a few thoughts on, you know, what's happened over that time?
I'm finding out that I was with ballclubs that opened ballparks, and their ballparks have been renewed, and some of them have fallen by the wayside, and I'm still hanging around. So I'm outliving ballparks now. Also, I've been with two expansions, the Angels and then the Diamondbacks. You know, it's mind-boggling, the steps that you take and how fortunate you are to be in this game, and people to continue to hire you to help them out if you possibly can. And it's a very humbling game, as you well know. And I found out the other day, the Diamondbacks have put together, they have a book called Diamondbacks Insider, and they have it for each new homestand. And you were passing them out the other day with my picture on it. A little inside story in it, and made pretty good reading. And at the end of the game, I'm walking up the stairs, and I'm seeing they've been discarded. And then I saw a few people step right on my face. I'm supposed to be thrilled that they had me on the cover. But here I am, I showed up anyway today, despite the fact that I was humiliated this past week. I can tell you some other horror stories, but this is a great game. And as I often say, the good old days are now. I enjoyed each decade for what it was worth and the growth of the game. But then when you look at it now, it's still the greatest game in the world.
I want the other panelists to feel free to chip in with anything they'd like to say. Now we have plenty of things to cover. One of the biggest changes during the last 40 years, it's shown up on the field, but really takes place off the field, and that's the abolition of the reserve clause and the advent of free agency. Wes, you started your career before the baseball draft, signing with the Dodgers in 63, played your whole career there under one manager. How have you seen things change what was it like in the pre-draft era? How's that changed? And do you think you came along too soon, or would you rather play later?
No, I did not come along too soon. There have been more changes than I can mention. I've heard this ever since I started playing the game, or ever since I retired, about don't you wish you were playing now and making the kind of money that these guys are making. No, I'm absolutely happy when I played. I just wish I'd been making more money at that time. And I think you can see the reason that the changes that have evolved in baseball, and you can see a lot of the results of it with the Dodgers today. I know somebody's going to ask that question, so let me just say that I'm disgusted. Absolutely disgusted with the situation, the jewel of Major League Baseball, along with the Yankees, Red Sox, Cubs, or St. Louis Cardinals. To see them in this type of situation is very discouraging and disgusting. But in terms of changes, free agency has without a doubt been the biggest change since I stopped playing. And not just free agency itself, but the changes that it has brought into baseball, a greater emphasis, for instance, on home runs, because of the money that's out there, players changing teams more often, rosters turning over as much as 30% in one winter, which never used to happen. I can remember those of you who grew up in L.A., Vin Scully used to say in the late 50s, early 60s, hey folks, get your tickets now, the St. Louis Cardinals are coming into town this weekend with Stan Musial, Bob Gibson, Bill White, Kenny Boyer, etc. So you knew as fans what players were on each team. They didn't move. They were always going to be there. Giants were always going to have Willie Mays, Marshall, McCovey. And you'd buy your tickets to see these people. So the game was as much an attraction of individual stars as it was particular teams. And it's not like that anymore. And this is my biggest objection to what's happened with free agency. It's benefited the players, absolutely. But it has not benefited you as fans, because you cannot invest your hearts anymore in particular ball clubs and in particular players. Because those players that maybe are on your own team, maybe on the Dodgers today, will be playing for the Giants next year. They will be your enemy. They're your loyal friends today, your enemies tomorrow. Which makes it very difficult for you to invest your hearts as a real fan into these players and these ball clubs. That is my biggest objection. It's also changed the game. It's also changed the game. If you remember back, we have historians here. And let me just say this too. It's a pleasure to see this room full of real baseball fans. Thank you for coming. One point. You go back to the 1920s. Ty Cobb hated Babe Ruth for changing baseball. For Babe Ruth, baseball was moving runners around the bases, bunting, hitting, running, placing your hits, making the right kinds of outs, working runners around the base, working hard to score one run. And Babe Ruth came along, changed baseball, one swing, he hits a three-run homer. Well, that's what's happened with free agency. It has again changed the game. Maury Wills, Lou Brock, Ricky Henderson, the base stealers, they brought back the tight cup type of baseball. But what we're seeing now is more of a home run game, more of a video game, with hitters using. When I played and Roberto Clemente played, we used bats that were 36 inches long, 36 ounces in weight. These guys today are using bats that are 33 ounces or inches long and 33 ounces in weight, because they're trying to buggy whip the ball out of the ballpark. So you're seeing a different ball game. Not the game that most of you grew up with. It's a different kind of game. I don't know if you like that or not. I personally don't. I like to see more intelligence in the game. I like to see a team have to work to score a run and not have guys up there trying to jack a ball out of the ballpark. And I know that they're guessing on your pitch, because on 2-0 and 3-1 counts, where you're looking for a specific pitch, and you don't swing unless the ball is exactly where you want it. And I see these guys swinging the pitches that bounce in the dirt. Now that tells me that their head's in the wrong place. They're guessing. They're going to swing no matter what, and that is not intelligent baseball. So, yes, these guys are bigger, stronger, faster, better athletes. They're all on web gems on ESPN, which we didn't have when I was playing. So we're all thinking about, hey, I got to make a great play so I can be on the webcams tonight on SportsCenter. But they don't think. They don't think as well as we used to do. That's it.
Dennis, you've been on both sides. You were an executive with the White Sox, and then you were a player agent. So you've seen things from both sides. You have a perspective. Which side would you rather be on if you had a choice?
Well, first of all, for me, baseball hasn't really been just a business or a sport. For me, it's been my way of life. You know, from the time I was old enough to remember, I was flipping baseball cards and trading cards and watching as many games as I could, listening to the radio up from Southern California, and I couldn't wait to listen to Bill Brundage do the Yankee game, and every time there was a hit, he'd go jump fly ball, and he was doing the games by ticker tape. That's how I grew up listening to the game. I'd have loved to have been a field manager. I'd love to have been any part of the game I could have been. But I will tell you, the greatest experience I ever had in a game was after being part of the 2005 Chicago White Sox, standing on the pitching mound, because Roland's wife, Margo, forced me out there to take a picture with our owner, and you probably remember that. And we won the World Series, and I don't ever take this ring off. I'll tell you, there's nothing in the world like winning a World Series. It's indescribable, and it almost makes you want to cry when you think about it.
Go figure. No sport relies on statistics and numbers as much as baseball. 4 years ago, we had wins, losses, earned run average, batting average. Now we have WHIPs, WARs, quality starts, OPS, DIPs, etc. John DeJuan, you've been a big part and seen many changes over the last 4 years. You want to expound on those a little bit?
Sure, Tom. Thanks. First of all, I have to say how jealous I am. I'm sitting here. I'm a Chicago fan since I was 4 years old. Grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I'm sitting here with two people wearing Sox rings. I am so jealous. They're so fun to look at. I wish I had them. Maybe someday in my dreams. Well, Tom asked me to try to cover four decades of baseball analytics.
Yes!
I love it. Tom asked me to try to cover four decades of Sabre and baseball analytics, and if you got 4 hours, I'll try to do it in 4 hours. No, I'll try to do it as quickly as possible, but I break it up into the decades. So you look at the 70s, and there were those of us who were closet statisticians. And some of the closet statisticians came out of the closet in 1971 when Time and Company founded Sabre, the Society of American Baseball Research. What a great name. And, you know, at that time, there wasn't a lot going on. A few people were doing a little bit of research. Dick Kramer, my future partner, was doing some research. And I was drafting my Stratomatic team based on batting errors. And I got whooped. I got whooped because the guys who drafted players who could walk, the guys who drafted players who could help hit home runs did a lot better. So it needed to be a combination of things, and not just batting average. And that's all we had in the 70s. Then we go to the 80s, and I call this the groundbreakers era. And we have three of the biggest groundbreakers era in this panel right now. We got Roland Heeman. He was one of the first GMs, when he was a GM of the White Sox in the early 80s, one of the first GMs to start databasing information that could help his team. And that made a big difference for the club. The 83 White Sox, so one of the best teams I've ever seen. I really loved that team. And Dennis Gilbert, one of the first player agents to take an analytical approach to player performance and how to use that to analyze his players and do the best he can for his players. And of course, John Thorne, with Pete Palmer, wrote, and if you haven't read this book, you know, go back and read it because it is enlightening. The Hidden Game of Baseball from 1984 was absolutely groundbreaking. I learned so much reading that book, and OPS was something that came out of that book for me as being a fantastic stat. They showed that it's actually better if you multiply on base times slugging, but no one can do that in their head. So, but probably the biggest groundbreaker of them all was Bill James. And Bill James wrote the baseball abstracts. Every year on the New York Times bestseller list, stacks of books stacked up at the bookstores, and he brought it to the public. He showed those of us how to analyze baseball in particular using the numbers. And he was a great writer, and he really did. One of my favorite stories of what he was called, the little fat man with a beard. What does this guy know about baseball? He's a little fat man with a beard. Well, if you know Bill, if you've met him before, he's a big fat man. He's a big grizzly bear and the nicest guy in the world. But so his comment to that was, well, two out of three ain't bad. But Bill's book was my revelation, and that's how I got into it. I read what Bill wrote, as many of us in this room probably did. Many of us probably joined Sabre because Bill encouraged us to join Sabre. And in 1984, he started a project called Project Scoresheet, and I sat at my kitchen table and I was mesmerized, and I said, I gotta get involved with this. And I looked him up on Directory Assistance, called his office, got a hold of his assistant, Jim Baker, and I became the director of the executive director of Project Scoresheet. And then those of us continued on from Project Scoresheet, went in to do other things. So several of us, Bill James and Dick Kramer and myself, went off to set up Stats Incorporated and started in a bedroom in my house. And David Smith went on to do RetroSheet, which is a tremendous project going back, gathering the play-by-play of games going back into the 50s. Bill James invented the term sabermetrics. Saber, S-A-B-R, became S-A-B-E-R, sabermetrics, the analytical study of baseball. Craig Wright became the first sabermetrician on a team with the Rangers. Fantasy baseball, rotisserie baseball, started getting fans more interested. The 90s now, I call the information explosion. And at Stats, our mission was to explode the world of baseball information. So we got our information out to the Associated Press and the AOL and ESPN and different books that we did. And other disciples of Bill James started to do their own thing. Baseball Prospectus and all the good work that they do. Ron Chandler's Baseball Forecaster. John Benson did a bunch of books on fantasy. But now, all you young guys, you don't have to be closet statisticians anymore, because in the 2000s, the analytics grow prime time, and we see all kinds of things happening. Michael Lewis's Moneyball made it clear that you can use analytics at the team level and make a difference on your club. And so now, almost every club has a stat guy that they use. And a lot of teams have a stat staff, an analytical staff. The Red Sox, the Indians, the White Sox have a whole staff that are using analytics. There's a product called BATS, B-A-T-S, that almost every team has. It takes video of ball players, it takes data from companies like mine, from Baseball Info Solutions, matches those up, and helps pitchers, hitters, understand, you know, what pitches are swinging at, what pitches they shouldn't be swinging at. So the information age in the 2000s has really made a big difference. Research communities, Fangraphs, tremendously deep information. Baseball Reference, the complete statistical history of baseball. Hardball Times, Tom Tangle's book. All this is happening these days, and it's really made a big difference in you know, that what has happened over so many years. It's been such a tremendous transition. We have the new technology, multiple camera angles, analyzing every ball that's hit from sports vision with pitch FX and hit FX and field FX and radar technology being used by TrackMan, new iPod and iPhone apps, MLB at bat, one of the coolest apps there is. Fangraphs has an app, Bloomberg, even Bill James has baseball IQ and baseball matchups. And then the last thing I want to touch on is my specialty now, which is defensive analysis. Because this has been the holy grail, and now we're able to use some of the real in-depth information and come up with how to measure players defensively. UZR, Mitchell Lickerman, and runs saved that are on Fangraphs, and total runs at baseballreference.com. I've done the Fielding Bible books and the Fielding Bible awards, and so we're really starting to get a handle of using analytics to try to measure things defensively. So finally, I want to mention this thing. There's a book called Wizardry. This came out about the defense in the history of baseball. And Wes Parker, six-time Gold Glove winner. Is it really true you were a good Gold Glover? What do us analytical types think of Wes Parker? Can we go back and look at the numbers? Well, sure enough, we go back and we look at the numbers, and we look at the play-by-play, and we're able to find that, based on the numbers, that Wes Parker is truly one of the top 25 defensive first basemen in the entire history of baseball. So. I want to read you one quick thing that I'm going to turn over. I want to read a quote from Bill James because this is what analytics is about. Bill wrote, "I will never understand baseball. I will never understand 1% of what I need to understand. My view of our work is that we are attacking a mountain range of ignorance with a spoon and a used toothbrush. The things that we do not know are inexhaustible. So we will continue to keep learning." And I want to second Rich Lederer's nomination of Bill James for the Hall of Fame because this man taught us more.
Diversity. That's a word we didn't hear much in 1971. Sabre was founded at the Hall of Fame the day after Satchel Paige was inducted as the first Negro League player into the Hall of Fame. 3 weeks after Sabre was founded, the Pittsburgh Pirates started the first all-minority lineup in baseball history with a mixture of African-American and Latin-American players. The last few years, we've seen a decline in the participation of African-American players in baseball, and Dennis has been active with Major League Baseball's RBI program. Dennis, could you tell us a little bit about what you see baseball can do to increase minority participation?
I think baseball is doing a heck of a job right now in funding the urban youth academies all over the country. I know they have plans to build an academy in New Orleans, in Cincinnati. They've got one in Houston. They have one here in Compton. They're converting the field that I built. I didn't really build it, I just made a little check. Somebody else built it. But it's a real passion of mine. I grew up in the inner city, and I was fortunate enough to be the only white player on a team that included people like Bob Watson, Reggie Smith, Bobby Tolan, Doc Ellis. Our bat boy was Eddie Murray. But the infield had no grass, and in right center you had a water fountain. So if you played in the outfield, you had to learn how to play the water fountain. It was a little difficult in those times. If you wanted to watch the game and not get out of your car, you could pull right up to the fence just about, and the dugouts were just a bench with a screen in front of it. I mean, that's what we have in the inner cities, at least what we had when we were growing up. These new fields are going to help and bring back some some of the players of that caliber to baseball. They say that there's a decline in African Americans. Jimmy Lee Solomon, who works for Major League Baseball, is on a mission to make sure that in every major city in the country that there are fields and places to play in the inner city. Most of these kids just can't afford it. They come from broken homes, they come from places where they have no uniforms, no bats, gloves, or balls, and donations from people like yourselves, like myself. That's all they really have to get themselves started. Junior colleges all over the country, especially here in Los Angeles, five or six of them have actually canceled their baseball programs because they couldn't afford it. I think, organizations like this, and making donations, as people do to RBI and Urban Youth Academy, can only help. And you got to tip your hat to Major League Baseball because they're behind it. They cut checks for millions of dollars a year just for helping. In fact, some teams, I'm proud to be a member of the White Sox, where our owner, Jerry Reinsdorf, personally donated $5 million to inner city baseball. Hopefully, that'll turn it around.
John Thorne, from a historical context, is the change we're seeing in player demographics something new, or has baseball faced this before?
Baseball, like other sports, and you all know this, is a great social elevator. And athletic skill will take you farther up the financial ladder and up the cultural and social ladders than almost anything. So in the 1880s, we had an Irish boom, followed by an Italian boom, followed by a Jewish boom. Ethnic waves in baseball come and go. I am less concerned personally at the dip in the percentage of African American players at the major league level than others may be. I do believe in the RBI program and restoring baseball to the inner city. But if the percentage of African Americans on the field diminishes from, say, 13% to 6-point-something, that's in part a reflection of the greater opportunities available to African Americans in other fields. Otherwise, we would be bemoaning the declining percentage of Jewish dentists. So, if we're going to jump out the window on this issue, let's be sure we're on the first floor. Diversity is much to be desired, and Tom, what Albert Spalding's tour, 1888 and 1889, where he attempted, by bringing two all-star teams of major league players on a round-the-world tour, to make the national pastime the international pastime. He did this in part out of love of the game and in part out of a wish to sell more bats and balls and gloves. I think he had the right motive. I think he was wrong by about 125 years. I think the international pastime is what baseball is becoming. This is the great growth area for baseball. And if you're looking at diversity, let's talk about when we're going to have a woman Major League Baseball player. 52% of the population and not a single representative at the Major League level. Now, I'm not suggesting some kind of accelerated program just to have an Eddie Goodell type freak show experience. But there is no anatomical, cultural, physical, social reason why women are taller and stronger and better coordinated than they were 100 years ago. So are men. It seems to me that a woman relief pitcher, a woman second baseman, seems not implausible. And I would be eager to have Sabre's support to the extent that it does. And I don't mean financially. I know we have a Women in Baseball Research Committee, and the rise of women in baseball is a tremendously interesting field. English baseball in the 18th century, the 1740s and the 1750s, was played largely by women. It is to young girls and women that we owe a very game to baseball. So diversity, to me, is a big issue. Tom, if I may grab the microphone a little harder. On the statistical side, I have much blood on my hands with Hidden Game of Baseball and Total Baseball and other writings. I have found that as I've become older, my interest in ever more refined measures of offensive performance has waned. And I believe that continuing progress in baseball analytics, and particularly defensive metrics, I love what John and NFL Solutions are doing. As a historian, my question is, are we simply comparing this player to that player, and are we only concerned with player evaluation and missing the bigger picture? Are we gaining more data and perhaps turning our backs on more understanding? I leave that as an open question.
We want to leave some time for questions from the audience. We don't have a microphone, but if anyone would like to ask something, would line up somewhere, not in front of this camera, but over to this side. Watch out for the cameras, give you a little time to get over there. And while you do, I know you're going to have some questions that I have here, and I'm not going to ask them. I'm going to ask one question while anyone that wants to ask lines up over here, and that is of everyone on the panel. I think the general perception of baseball is that it's better now than it was 40 years ago. The question I have is, in which way do you think baseball is better 40 years ago than it is now? I have one, and I think the players' attitude towards the fans might have been a little better 40 years ago, and if you got an autographed ball, you could read the name on it. I'll throw that out. I'd be interested in everyone's opinion on that. How is baseball better 40 years ago than it is today?
How many of you, and I see the hats, how many of you grew up watching Pacific Coast League baseball? Okay. You remember Hollywood Stars, LA Angels, San Diego Padres, right here in Southern California. How intimate that experience was. You go to Gilmore Field, I think, you sat in the first row, you were maybe 15 feet from the playing field. 15 feet. You don't get that anymore. In Crosley Field in Cincinnati, and also in Sportsman's Park in St. Louis, the players used to walk through the stands to get to the ball field. So my point is this, that the intimacy, the connection between fan and player has eroded, the closeness, which I pointed out before, but it's not the same. It's hard to get an autograph now out of a player because these guys are multimillionaires. And who are you compared to that? And that's how a lot of them are thinking. They don't have as many that are perceptive enough to realize that you are paying those salaries and that are not promoting the game as much as they should. So to me, that's been a crucial difference.
There is a thing I refer to in print a couple of times as the paradox of progress, and that's that we all recognize that the game on the field is better, yet somehow we feel that it's worse. And what's that all about? It's about us getting older.
He talked about team play and whatever. You ought to watch Kirk Gibson and the Diamondbacks play. He is so about players on how to approach the game, give it your best day in and day out, be kind to the fans, and sign autographs and what have you. And Kirk is symbolic of the old-time players who went all out. I used to be a fourth when he was at first base, that we'd lose a shortstop, the second baseman, in about 30 seconds. But he has instilled a spirit that's very rewarding to watch and exhilarating for me to see. a group of guys, a lot of the names people are not all that familiar with, but he's getting more mileage out of them than anyone would expect.
I just wanted to jump in on John's comment about getting old, because I think getting old, there is a certain nostalgia for what the game was like when you were young, and I certainly have a special place in my heart for the 1960s White Sox. But what's really cool is that, and this organization is a perfect example of that, baseball is a sport where you can enjoy the game based on many different levels. And, you know, there are so many committees inside of Sabre. One group enjoys baseball because they like going to cemeteries and looking at headstones of players who used to die, or who died. That's great. You know, it keeps track of players, and you learn about those players. And, you know, some people like the uniforms, and some people just like sitting at the ballpark eating hot dogs and drinking beer. It doesn't matter why you love this game. And, you know, those of us love statistics, but it doesn't matter. That's what's great about the game of baseball. We all have different loves. We all have different things that we enjoy about it. And whatever it is that you enjoy about it, just enjoy it.
James Sabre for having educated baseball people in front of offices or in uniform as to pay attention to details. And I recall when the early stages of Tony Bruce's career, now computer information was being provided, said, "Roland, I look forward to getting as much information as anyone wants to supply. I'll still use judgment as to when I would use it, and knowing my own players, what they can do and not do." And I was a big Tony La Russa fan. Lauren Bay was a manager at Denver, and he got sick a couple of times, and he had Tony run the club, and he called me and he said, "Roland, pay attention to this young man. He has the makings of being a fine manager." And I passed on that information to Bill Vack, and I made sure that Tony had an audience with Bill a couple of days in Sarasota during spring training, and Bill says, "You're right, this young man's going to go places." But he was smart enough to accumulate information provided by sabermetricians, and so you can be proud of the fact that Tony La Russa is now the third winningest manager in baseball history. It can be attributed to that great mind of his, and not close the fact of what people can provide. So thank you, guys.
Okay, let's take a new question. My question is for Wes Parker. Wes, can you tell us from your perspective what happened in 1968 to make it the phenomenal year of the pitcher that it was? It seems to me that the players of 68 were essentially, the key players, were the same as 1964, when the stats were more or less normal. What happened in 68?
Good question. I'm assuming, I was there, but I'm still assuming that it was the raising of the pitching mound, partly. And it just seemed to be an era when there were a plethora of great pitchers like Lon Marichal, Bob Gibson, Steve Carlton. Jerry Royce was pitching then, and he was great. Tom Seaver was there. Nolan Ryan was just starting his career. Koufax had gone. Drysdale was still pitching. Sutton was just starting. Later on, you have James Rodney Richard and some other. Well, Jim Maloney with Cincinnati is one of the most underrated pitchers ever. Man threw 100 miles per hour. It was just an era when there were, for whatever reason, a massive amount of great pitchers. And we were talking earlier, Carl Yastrzemski won the American League batting title with a 301 batting average. He was the only one in the whole league to hit 300 that year. So that's the best I can do. Maybe somebody else has another idea, but there were good hitters around. We just weren't hitting, I think, because of the height of the mound, which changed the angle of the pitch. And most players are taught to have a level swing, and now you have a pitch coming from high to low, even a fastball, not a sinker, and you've got two different planes trying to intersect, and it makes it much more difficult. You almost had to change your swing to an uppercut in order to meet the plane of the pitch, and I think very few guys were willing to make that alteration. And plus, there were some, I think, some bigger ballparks were starting to be built. I know the Astrodome was hard to hit a home run in. And AstroTurf was coming in, artificial grass, so the infielders would play deeper and cut off base hits and throw you out on a bounce. They'd bounce the ball first and throw you out. So I think that also had something to do with it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
Mr. John Doerr, could you explain a little more what is the understanding of the game that we may be losing by overhead analysis?
Larry Ritter used to say that the best part of baseball today is yesterday. And I think that in trying to make baseball a more exciting and modern and analytical game, something that resembles third down linebackers coming in, nose tackles coming out for the third down in passing situations, where specialization is an undeniable trend in life. Baseball's pitching patterns are becoming more and more specialized. John McGraw said in the 1920s that he thought there was just no point to a designated hitter. Why not just go all the way and have a defensive team and an offensive team? I think that's where we're headed. Maybe not in the lifetime of anybody in this room, but baseball is becoming increasingly specialized, increasingly analyzed, and it is the romance and story of the game that is the lifeblood. When we sit around the dinner table with our kids and we talk about Walter Johnson or Babe Ruth or Ted Williams, we don't talk about their OPS. And I believe that we need to give something of a restorative balance to the position of story in the transmission of baseball values to the next generation so that it doesn't become the equivalent of analyzing tout sheets from the racing forms or stock charts from the Wall Street Journal.
Next. Come on. Okay.
I'm a little stuck, so
that's fine.
Oh, that's my question. forgive me, I have laryngitis. Another question for Wes. As you can see, I'm a Montreal Expos fan, and I was curious to how the players reacted to going to Montreal for the first few times, because it's a different city in a different country that speaks a different language, and I just wanted to get an idea, with lots of pretty girls too, by the way, and I just wanted to get
we loved it. And interesting story, usually when we went to a major league city to play on the road, we stayed in a convention hotel like a Sheraton or a Marriott or a Hilton, and there would always be crowds of people. When we went to Montreal the first time, I think the hotel was the Queen Elizabeth's.
Yeah.
And we could not believe that we were in a first-class hotel. Couldn't believe it. And Montreal had the nicest people and the most interesting nightlife. It wasn't like you meet markets like you experience a lot in LA nightclubs. You'd go there and groups of women would come, groups of guys would come, and you'd all just get together and talk, dance, eat, whatever. It was more civilized, is how I would put it. It was a very civilized city, and of course, Jerry Park, where we played, was a very small ballpark, so we loved that aspect of it as well. But you should be proud of Montreal. I'm sorry it's not around anymore. Also, they had a great farm system. Great farm system. Boy, they turned out ball players beautifully.
We're going to have to be out of here in about 5 minutes. John Hallway, got a question. Oh, you don't? Okay, Bob.
Wes, refresh my memory. Did you play with that all switch hitting infield?
Yes.
What, is that the only one in history? Or?
Yes, John. You probably know better than I, but yeah, 1965 and 66, we had Jim Gilliam at third, Maury Wills at short, Jimmy LeFevre at second, myself at first, all switch hitters. They told us at the time it never happened before. Incidentally, I'm going to put in a plug. I know time is limited, but Roberto Clemente was the best ball player I ever saw. Better than me.
Cliff, last question.
I grew up in a generation that played ball and loved to play ball, and my perception of ball of baseball is baseball now. I don't think the kids nowadays play ball like we used to. Do you have any?
Me?
Well, the whole panel, I mean.
I do worry sometimes that it's too organized for the kids, and they get depressed if they're playing right field because he's the worst player on the team and never gets a baseball. So that as we grew up and played on sand lots, you played rotation, so you played every position that given day 5 or 6 times as you rotated. So we throw out the baseballs and bats and have fun, kids. And maybe we should go back to that.
Yeah, get rid of the adults, you know. When we were kids, we just go out and play, right? Adults, go away. Just give us the bat, give us the ball, give us the glove, and let's just go play. That's what I did when I was a kid growing up, playing hours a day, every day.
Yeah, but it starts in grammar school. It really does. Public school systems out here, they all complain that they don't have money, and so what's the first thing they do is they cancel PE. The old games, softball, softball, they don't do it anymore. They just don't do it anymore because they don't. But to give the kids time to shower in junior high school or to clean up afterward. And then the kids that would play the softball games or the kickball games that we played when we were youths, they don't experience that stuff anymore. They go in there and they may go in and they say, go lift weights or go do this. It's a whole different mentality.
Dennis, don't you think computers have a lot to do with that? They're inside working computers, going on the internet instead of going outdoors and playing ball.
You know, in some respect, you're 100% correct. But it all depends on the people teaching them. Everybody, I'm from the ground up. You know, and I believe in the old games of stickball, over the line, kickball, kick the can, anything you can to stay active. Kids today just don't do it. I just put 3 kids through school, and I watched it. None of us in grammar school or junior high school, and really even in high school, had any real gym periods the way we have them growing up. And I can see where the whole idea of competing, the thrill of winning, I mean, the thrill of competing is gone in that respect. And I think that's where we're losing an awful lot of our youth.
I can't believe that we've gotten through that without a question about Pete Rose, steroids, the designated hitter, or Wes Barker's role on the Brady Bunch. I'd like to thank all of our panelists for being with us. Now, most of us won't be in Cooperstown. Some of us will. Roland Heeman will be presented the Buck O'Neill Lifetime Achievement Award for his extraordinary efforts to enhance baseball's positive impact on society. Roland, congratulations.